walking in another person's shoes, tuning in to the needs of others, feeling the urge to hug someone in tears. This is compassion. Compassion has a reputation for being soft-hearted, but its benefits are based on well-studied mathematics, neuroscience, as well as evolutionary biology. However, we all experience it differently.
When my son was born, every time he cried, I cried. And one of my mentors said, "Oh, you'll get over that." And it really has not happened. If you started crying right now, I would probably start crying as well. So we are, I think, in general, a species that's quite susceptible to the emotions of others.
This is Dr. Amy Parrish, a biological anthropologist and Darwinian feminist. For her, compassion is something we humans share with other primates like bonobos, one of our closest living relatives. She's been researching them for over 20 years.
The most fascinating thing about them was that unrelated females were able to form sustained, very positive relationships with each other. And that's virtually unheard of in mammals. Usually in mammals, females are avoidant or antagonistic or even downright aggressive with each other unless they have a bond that is based on kinship.
So what is the explanation for that? Why do they come along with each other so well?
Bonobo females have a lot to gain by bonding with each other because that allows them to form effective coalitions with each other, and they then use those coalitions to attack and dominate males. Females spend a lot of time together. They act as a unit for the good of all of the females so that females aren't subjected to violence by males, to infanticide of their infants, to sexual aggression. So I think there are a lot of reasons for them to try to band together and form a female-dominant society.
While bonobo females seem to get along pretty well, why do we see so much competition going on with other species in the animal world? According to Parrish, the researchers' cultural backgrounds may affect their perspective on the animals they study.
Evolutionary biologists working in a Western tradition were always looking at competition and nature red in tooth and claw. And it's primarily been the Asian branch of primatology, particularly the Japanese, who've looked more at the cooperative side, although there are some exceptions. Franz De Waal once wrote an article that he labeled Survival of the Kindest, and it was based on an experience he had with me in Thailand. And we went to a zoo where the zoo had inherited some baby tiger cubs one night and didn't have a tiger mother to nurse them. And so they put them with a mother dog and her puppies, and the mother dog happily reared these tigers and these puppies together. And so now the zoo has an exhibit with four huge tigers and four medium-sized dogs, and they play and they bite each other in the neck, but the tigers never eat the dogs. And so Franz was struck by that. And he said, you know, why would a mother dog rear a potential predator for her own offspring if there weren't more to life than this nature red in tooth and claw? And I think broadly he's right about that.
I actually came across with an article where they mentioned your name and this one incident when you took your newborn son to the bonobos. So what happened?
I think he was about 5 or 6 months old, and I went back to a population of bonobos that I had studied quite extensively, so the bonobos know me very well. And one of the females was really excited to see me, and she kept vocalizing and standing up bipedally, which makes them look very human, and clapping her hands and nodding her head and looking between my face and my son's face back and forth. And then she went away and got the baby that she had had since the last time I had been there and held him up by his little arms. And we kind of had this maternal moment of exchanging information about what had been going on in our lives. And clearly both of us had had babies. We do share so much in common that it's not surprising that I could have that interchange with that bonobo where we held up our babies and, even though we didn't speak the same language, could clearly communicate with each other about what had been happening in our lives.
For Amy Parrish, this is crucial. We humans share the capacity for compassion with other primates. In this way, we are not unique. In academia, it's taken some time to get this idea accepted.
In the past, every biologist was trained not to anthropomorphize other animals as if we were separate and unique and distinct. I have friends who studied monkeys where they wouldn't give them names. Instead, they gave them letters and numbers. But we all know who their favorite monkey was. It was L21. And L21 is as much of a name as Rika or Amy or Stephanie. Once you've heard a whole bunch of stories about her and been sent a Christmas poster of her to put up in your house. So it really doesn't come as a surprise to me that other primates share this capacity for empathy and compassion, cooperation, anger, sorrow, happiness. It seems quite natural to me. And really, like, the default hypothesis actually would be that we're not special and unique, that we just fall along a continuum.
As bonobos lead their life with a make love, not war attitude, the human race sometimes lacks pacifism in a big scale. Greg Chadwick, a painter and an artist based in Santa Monica Art Studios, considers art as a tool for attracting and reinforcing compassion. He creates stories within his canvases, opening a portal and letting the viewer inside. He's empathetic with his subjects, often ordinary people, faces in a crowd, and invites us to see them from an intimate lens. Sitting in his studio, several portraits look at me with wide, inviting eyes, dragging me into their worlds. One, hanging by my head, is of a young boy.
I ran across this picture of this young black gentleman. He was probably like 8 years old, and with this hat on that made him seem so much older and wiser in a way, and I just thought, I've got to put this into a painting. I need to let this individual be out to see if he can get a chance to tell his own story. So I particularly emphasize the eyes. There's the idea the eyes are a window to the soul or a window to other experiences for us to travel through and see what's happening there.
I love the eyes in both of these paintings, and it really gets me to think, what are they thinking? What are they feeling? Which is exactly the point of compassion and empathy.
I want there to be an openness of possible communication, of possible storytelling, of don't just think about yourself at this moment. Maybe you can stop and put yourself in my shoes a little bit and think about me and think what's going on in this world. Maybe you've never thought that way. And that's one of the things I love about the arts, is how we are transported. We're transported into another person's way of looking at the world. And what a gift that we have as humans to have these experiences, to put on, you know, the coat that somebody else wears, so to speak, and to wander into these stories or adventures or, you know, sadness and tragedy, but to come out more fully human and more connected as a global shared sense of humanity.
This shared sense of humanity has driven him to paint art that evokes peace and justice. This year, he painted about Ferguson. He was inspired by the snapshot of a young man flinging a cylinder of police-aimed tear gas away from peaceful protesters.
I felt that the photograph expressed so much, but I wanted to turn it into a painterly language as well. The Wild West story of America that, you know, we're out there getting bad guys has infected us. And compassion, I think, is a cure. You know, when it's your son who's being gunned down, when it's your family, okay, fine. Well, I like to think that we're all in one family and that any life that is lost is a tragedy. If we can, you know, create a world where losses are mourned together, I think it'd be just a much more beautiful, beautiful place. And I like to think my art can be a small part of that.
In painting a person, a protester, a stranger, or a friend, Chadwick is unveiling layers of who they are.
Getting to know them is part of the process of the painting. There's no doubt about it. So it's always a search to understand who's going to end up in the piece and also who they are and what they want to express. It's kind of a give and take between subject and viewer. And even when it's a painting of somebody I know well, my brother, when we were both students in college, I needed to do a portrait, so I had him sit for me. And, he told me years later, I was so bored. I couldn't believe I'm sitting here for hours and what are you doing? And of course, I gave him the painting and now he treasures it.
That's such an interesting way of knowing someone and seeing someone for who they are, to paint them.
It really is, and it's only afterwards that when people talk to me about what it means to them. I did a portrait of my friend Yareli Arizmendi, so it became hers. Yareli has this painting in her house, and she looks at it every day, and she's come up to me and said, "You really see me, and I see myself in this painting as well." But I think it gets back to the idea of compassion, to really try to feel the humanity and the story that somebody else carries with them.
A great piece of art has the ability to reinforce our compassion by inviting us to look the world with somebody else's eyes. But what would convince an ambitious modern person to practice empathy in everyday life? Casey Cole, a science writer and author, has found motivation for compassion from physics as well as from mathematics.
I'm very comfortable with ambiguity, and I'm very comfortable with thinking, I don't agree with that person, but, you know, they probably see something I don't see.
Cole says there's a mathematical argument for the golden rule, the rule saying that you should treat others the way you'd like others to treat yourself.
It really surprised me because I'd never thought of an idea from physics or math being so directly to something that has to do with how you feel about others, right? Do unto others as you would have others do unto you, which is basically saying that you should be able to change places between the doer and the doee, and it shouldn't make a difference. So this idea that differences shouldn't make a difference, at least for Frank Oppenheimer, my mentor physicist, is the fundamental way you get at truth. For example, in the physical world, electricity and magnetism are different, but actually they're part of the same thing. So that's a difference that doesn't make a difference. Skin color, that would be another difference that doesn't make a difference. And the more you look at it, the more you realize that differences that don't make a difference are how you find the fundamental commonalities between all people, what they all care about and what they all really value.
How should we apply this knowledge into our human relationships?
Yeah. How do you want to be treated? But, you know, I mean, Frank had said something else, which I think is also related to this, which was always the worst thing a son of a bitch can do is turn you into a son of a bitch. When I started reading his writings, he was talking about things like Cuba and Vietnam, where, say, the United States went in and we were the good guys fighting the bad guys. The bad guys won because they made us worse guys than they were. And when you think about that on a personal level, which I do all the time, you know, you're going to fight with somebody over a parking space, you're going to go into road rage, and you think, okay, the worst thing that can happen is that I can become like they are.
Casey Cole says that physics has taught her a lot about empathy.
What you learn from physics is that you can have very seemingly contradictory points of view, which are both true. So it's okay to understand people, for example, right to life, who can at least empathize with the ideas, okay, you know, maybe you don't want to kill what you consider to be a life. At the same time, I want to protect a woman's right to control her own body. I don't have to be on one side or the other. I can see reality in both sides of that. And it has to do with everything from gun control. You know, are there really evil people in the world who we need to fight against and destroy? Yep, probably. Is that what we want to be doing all the time? No. There's almost nothing that's absolute. So it's interesting because it's very Cubist. All these ideas in physics came out at the same time the Cubist painting was happening, and people were saying, hey, you know, there are many different points of view of things, and the only way you really get at them is looking at all of them. Mm-hmm. Frank Oppenheimer often talked about the sentimental fruits of science. And what he meant by that was that science affects not only how we think, but how we feel about things. And our connection with our fellow humans is one of those things that understanding evolution really makes you feel differently.
When we think about like the Darwinian idea of survival of the fittest, how does that fit into this picture?
Yeah, survival of the fittest, what does that mean? It means that you have random mutations in how organisms adapt, and then they adapt depending on natural selection, right? Whatever fits that environment will succeed. Very often, that is cooperation. The thing that you need to succeed is cooperation. So when you look at a living cell, it's this community of all these different organelles that are cooperating. And cooperation has been as much of a force behind evolution all the way up the line, from cells to societies, as competition. We have families, we have, you know, groupings, we cooperate in all kinds of ways. And groups that cooperate win. So it's not just raw competition.
If being compassionate is both reasonable and logical, why do we still struggle with it so much? We invited Amy Parrish, Greg Chadwick, and Casey Cole to talk together about its challenges.
Is it really harder nowadays to be a compassionate person?
I would say, I mean, if you've read Jared Diamond's recent work, he claims we're in the most kind of peaceful period in human history ever recorded. And so I think you could argue that the glass is more than half full in terms of how we're doing. It certainly doesn't mean that there's not a lot of room for progress, but I certainly see a lot of reason for hope and change.
Okay, finally, I get to disagree. I don't. And there's so much research coming out about what happens as inequality in wealth and power increases. And it really makes powerful people into very unempathetic and uncompassionate, because they don't have to be. If you're the lower, if you're the minority, if you're the one who has to look up to, you better be able to read the signals that come from other people. But if you just do whatever you want, and there's actual research that areas of the brain atrophy that are associated with compassion. Now, the good news is it's temporary. So, you know, you can get it back. But I think that's extremely troubling. And even being surrounded by images of money, say you have a screensaver and it's dollar bills. I mean, I know this sounds bizarre, but this comes from Daniel Kahneman, who's a Nobel laureate in economics. So it's not just, you know, nonsense. People begin to act greedier just by having images. So it's unconscious priming. I think that's a really bad thing.
It's worked its way into the arts as well with, you know, the big thing is how many millions a Rothko will sell for, as opposed to how deeply does that touch somebody's heart and their soul? And it makes me cry, really. It's an awful situation when, you know, everything, how is it going to be monetized? How can you make money out of it, as if that's the sole worth? And I think that, you know, the arts and the sciences hopefully can help us pull back from that.
And then from neuroscience, we're learning all this stuff about how being compassionate actually makes you a healthier, happier, longer-lived person. You know, it's pleasurable. It's pleasurable to learn things, just like it's pleasurable to be nice to other people, actually, despite what the society would like to tell us.
Amy Parrish, Greg Chadwick, and Casey Cole will be speakers at Categorically Not, an event taking place this Sunday, December 7th at 6 p.m. at Santa Monica Art Studios.